Hey, Pod.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of History Time. It is story time with a historical precedent.
I love that.
Yes,
Catherine, I love that.
How are you? How is the world?
I am thriving. I can speak for both of us when I say we are both giddy with joy right now.
What? Tell us why.
Okay, so if you haven't noticed by now, History Time has a new look. Okay, we have a cute little thumbnail that is new and made by a local artist and one of like my friends, coaches, and mentor, Angelica Mercado. I don't think she's listening, but I guess she is. Thank you so much. We love it so much. We were both speechless.
Like, I still am speechless. I don't know what you're talking about.
I wish you could see like the messages we were sending to each other. We were like all caps, like
all caps,
using expletives. text effects, saying loud and like.
You know, awesome. when it's sent with slam, it's a big deal.
Oh yeah, and maybe slam like a million times. So yeah, we have a new look. Thank you, Angelica. Mm-hmm. So we also get accepted onto Apple Podcasts. Whoever listened to our podcast like said it was fine.
Like, and they're like, oh, these kids know what's going on.
They were like, okay, I suppose. And we were like, oh my gosh, let us bow at your feet.
I am looking at our podcast right now, just absolutely dumbfounded that this is a thing that's actually in fruition.
Like, wow, perpetual smiles on our faces. This is awesome. I love it.
This is the hype.
I love it. I love it. We're so excited.
That's what's happening. It's happening, y'all.
It's happening.
I feel like we should get a theme song next.
I'm like, shut up right now. I will go on GarageBand.
Let us know if you would like to hear us lay down some sick beats to History Time.
We're both ex-music kids. Well, you're currently a music kid
doing my online virtual choir assignments.
I definitely took like voice and choir lessons for like 6 years and then said, I have to go.
Her alto is a bit rusty.
Hey, I was a soprano too. Okay, I was a soprano there for a second.
She's one of those kids. Letting y'all know. So yeah. So Catherine, tell them at home, what are we talking about today?
We have two stories that are both...
Which we're not going to tell you the connection yet. We hope you can figure it out for yourselves.
No. Why would we do that? No. Mm-hmm. They seem very distant. They are. They're totally different. They're set in different time periods.
Millenniums apart, actually.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I'm going to be talking about the darker history of what I like to call green corporatism. Or corporate greenism. One of those. I don't know.
Or if you're me, and you at the end of the episode, you kind of babble like an idiot, saying, you know, when she's talking about the green corporate stuff.
Yeah. So, I won't define it. You'll have to wait until we get to my part of the story. Mm-hmm. But let's just say it will have you both kind of angry and on the edge of your seat and kind of like, what the hell?
It takes a second to get there, but anything worthwhile takes a second.
And let me tell you, it's worthwhile.
So whereas my story is kind of like candy, instant gratification, intrigue, murder, hers is like makes you pissed off and question your own existence.
Yeah. You know, just girly things.
Going back to my story, I'm taking us to the ancient times, where I tell you about a little girl who did quite a lot. And not enough people know about her because she's freaking amazing. We, as a history podcast, I feel have to mention people who don't get their credit in history. And she's certainly one of the people we need to marvel at a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Like, Catherine, did you have, like, any, like, idea of who this was before I told you about her?
No, not at all. And I was like, are you kidding? Why haven't I heard of this girl before?
Mm-hmm. It's a big deal because this little girl has her own drunk history episode.
Which I now have to watch.
Yeah. I like to think this podcast, too, is like drunk history, but entirely sober.
I'm dead.
Yeah.
So entirely it's like, sober.
Entirely sober. We're intoxicated with the thrill of historical context and continuity. But yeah. Now is the time where I'm going to share a quote with you all. And Catherine, I know this quote already, but it comes from former Argentina's former first lady, Eva Perón, inspired the musical Evita by Andrew Lloyd Webber. I did a documentary.
Andrew Lloyd! Oh my god, I'm sorry. He did Phantom of the Opera. Geek.
Thank you, Catherine. Catherine just freaks out for a second.
I love Phantom of the Opera.
Well, do you love Evita?
I've never watched.
Oh my goodness. Somewhere, Jamie, if she's listening to this, is just absolutely flabbergasted because we have bonded over our love for Evita. Anyways, this former first lady, who I did a documentary on once, was truly remarkable. Sometimes you have first ladies who don't really do much. Maybe they'll tackle school lunches and tackle obesity, diabetes, and important issues like that. Or they'll tell kids not to cyberbully and to quote-unquote just be nice.
Yes.
But power. Eva Perón, this is like a woman, I think that I remember this from my documentary, she would often work like 20-hour days. She's absolutely ridiculous. And she would work to better her Argentina because she came from nothing. She was one of Los Descamisados, as they were called.
Oh. And
what? Oh, yes. We both have our Spanish roots. Los Descamisados, Los Damnificados. So, yeah. This is a quote of hers I think is truly profound. She says, "My biggest fear in life is to be forgotten." Eva Perón.
Eva, you are not forgotten, sister. You are right here next to us, and thank you.
Does she deserve more praise, in my opinion? Yes.
Yes.
She, what a woman. No llores por mi para Argentina.
Shut up, I will cry.
Love her. Listen to the musical and you will cry. So other than that, on the topic of women who deserve more of their fair share of history, I'm going to begin with my story for today. We thank you again for tuning in. Grab your snacks, get comfortable, and enjoy his story time. All right, now that you've got your snacks and you're comfortable, get ready for an exciting story of murder and intrigue and feminism. Everything Catherine loves.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so today I'm going to be telling you guys about Arsinoe IV of Egypt, the Forgotten Queen, as I like to refer to her. So, we all know Cleopatra. Cleopatra is this girl's older sister, okay? They are maybe half-sisters, maybe full-sisters. It's debated, but it's not really important to this story. Cleopatra, obviously, is known for her seduction of Mark Antony and Julius Caesar. And she's known for getting things she wants out of both of those unions. So she kind of, like, played the game a little bit, you know? She was a fierce ruler.
That she did.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta use what you got to get what you want, you know? But on the other hand, we have a different type of leadership that's seen in this little Arsinoe girl. So yeah, I'm also just going to throw this out there. When I was doing my research for this, there's this really cool website, dangerouswomanproject.org. It looked really cool, and I want to do more digging into it. So that's a shameless plug, but it's a really cool website if you're savvy. Moving on right along to the story, though. So the first thing you should probably know about our girl Arsinoe is that her birth is very much so debated.
Her birth?
Her birth.
Her being born. What?
Yeah, exactly. No, they say she was born somewhere between 68 and 59 BC.
Oh, I see.
So she was born sometime in that decade. But for purposes, I think what was more common, she was born somewhere between 68 and 63 BC. Just absolutely crazy, okay? So she is one of five children of the previous ruler, King Ptolemy the Eighth. Or not King Ptolemy the Eighth, King Ptolemy the Seventh, excuse me. King Ptolemy the Eighth is her brother. And then, so the ones that we're going to talk about that are important, we've got King Ptolemy the Eighth, her brother, Cleopatra, Arsinoe the Fourth, obviously. She's our girl. And then we have this little bro who, in everything I read about him, they really emphasize that he was little, okay? I think he is the youngest child because he really sounds like he has youngest child syndrome.
Oh, he just has that energy.
He has that energy. You want to know why he has that energy?
Why?
Because I forgot about him.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
We are, in fact, refilming this segment because I forgot to talk about Ptolemy the 14th. The
little bro. There, and he's important to Blake. So
he's important to me because, like, he's the comedic relief in this story. I absolutely adore this little man. And, like, it's just funny. They're just, anytime it's not just, oh, Ptolemy the 14th. It is Lil Ptolemy the 14th. Like, I think
Lil.
There's some speculation going on there, but, like, this kid sits at the kids' table, most definitely.
I'm dead. He could be 21, but, you know, he's at the kids' table.
He's at the kids' table. Yeah. King Ptolemy the 14th. Who? sorry. Regardless, back to our girl Arsinoe. So, we believe she's fluent in multiple languages, Greek, Latin, what have you. So, she's very intelligent. Her name, Arsinoe, is of Greek origin, and it means woman with uplifted mind.
Damn.
Ooh. So, yeah.
Yeah, ooh. And she was. She freaking killed it.
She did kill it. So, yeah. So, around the time of her tween years, her two older siblings, Cleopatra and Ptolemy the Eighth, are co-rulers of Egypt, okay? They're, like, Cleopatra also makes Ptolemy the Eighth her brother husband.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't weird at the time.
In the context of the time,
everyone and their dog had a brother husband.
Jeez. You know?
For sure. however... Ptolemy and Cleopatra had some differences in ruling, and for all purposes, Ptolemy exiles Cleopatra out of Egypt because they can't get along.
He said bye.
He really said bye. Which is like if I were Cleopatra, I would be pissed.
I mean, yeah. You know? Like, who are you? Excuse me, I'm Cleopatra.
You're just my stupid brother husband.
Right. Oh. What the hell?
So she says, I don't need your love, and leaves. And then who rolls up? None other than the boy himself, Julius Caesar. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
So at this time, Julius Caesar is, like, kind of killing it in the Mediterranean. He has Gaul. He has North Africa. He has Rome. He's going to get Asia Minor. Like, he's got all of this. He's got it all going on. Then if you look at the Mediterranean, there's this tiny little corner by the Nile River Delta that he does not have. That's what we know as Egypt, okay? So it's also important to mention at this time, he's like, you know what? You two are your co-rulers, but at the same time, he's going to side with Cleopatra. So,
because Cleopatra is using her womanhood.
She's using her womanhood, yes. She uses her persuasive means to get what she wants out of this Julius Caesar guy, who she really vibes with. She really vibes with Julius. She sees him as, like, this great militaristic leader who, like, gets what he wants and, like, knows what he wants. Like, power move. She has such faith in this guy. At the same time, our boy Ptolemy the 14th and our girl, Arsinoe, they're looking after this tiny island of Cyprus. Which I like to think about it in terms of ruling as, like, the kids' table. So, like, ruling. Like, I imagine, like, Ptolemy's like, do you want to blade my hair? And then she's like, are you freaking kidding me? Like, I'm meant for more than this. I'm multilingual. And then Ptolemy's like,
this right now.
And Ptolemy's like, so no snack time?
Yeah.
And so,
how old was Ptolemy when she was, like, this age?
We don't know, but we know he's the youngest.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I can probably figure it out, but it's not important. And so she's like had this taste of ruling and whatever. Ptolemy though has taken over the throne as Caesar rolls up, and there's that sibling rivalry that's playing out. So then Cleopatra's like, "Hey yo, take this Ptolemy guy out, Julius Caesar. And Ptolemy's captured by Julius Caesar. And yeah. Arsinoe at this time gets a little bit wise. She realizes, oh, crap, there's this whole, like, descendant thing. I am in... She chuckles and says, ah-ha-ha, I am in danger. So what does she do? She grabs her mentor and her eunuch, Ganymedes. All right? Ganymedes sounds kind of badass, not gonna lie. So
yeah.
She takes her mentor and eunuch, Ganymedes, and she flees Alexandria, where this siege was happening. And then, this is an important discussion we have to have. At this time, she was between the ages, we believe, of 13 to 15.
Wow, imagine being that young and just, like, I couldn't form sentences. No. I'm convinced.
Like, Catherine, what were we doing? What were we doing when we were that age?
I was, like, reading Wattpad fan fiction. Yeah. Okay, that's what I was doing.
I was reading Twilight and getting real stressed out. Right. That's what I was doing. I was not fleeing the country because I was, like, an heir to the throne who needed to rise again like a phoenix from the ashes.
Yeah.
I was...
Like, I've never done that.
Electric blue gym shorts with an electric blue t-shirt and said, this is fashion at that time. That's where I was at. So... While we were doing such things, our homegirl, Arsinoe, she goes into the Egyptian desert where she meets a rebel Egyptian army. All right. Now, keep in mind, this teenage girl is going up to this army of men, and she's basically like, hey, I'm Arsinoe. My sister just linked up with this one really weird guy. I think he's kind of crazy. What can you do to help me out? And she meets this general of the army. His name is Achilles. So doesn't Achilles...
That sounds badass.
Doesn't Achilles sound like a badass? He sounds like what I think Russell Crowe's character in Gladiator is.
Yeah, he does.
Like, he has a very low voice. He only speaks in sentence fragments, but he, like, right. knows his business. He's got a troubled past. Like, he's got a daughter back home.
He sleeps in, like, gold armor.
Yeah.
Like, sleeps in it. And it's, like, comfortable for him. He's like, this is my true skin.
He'd give...
You know, something like that.
He'd give a hell of a rallying speech, though. I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
This Achilles guy.
Sentence fragments.
Yeah. However, this Achilles guy, we don't like him. We don't like him. He essentially scoffs at Arsinoe when she cries to him for help. But Arsinoe is also just like, hey, I need this army. Like, we need to go take back Alexandria from the forces that are trying to invade our home. And Achilles is like, nah, you're like 7. And then she goes, actually, I'm 11, so shut the fuck up.
I'm dead.
And when he doubts Arsinoe like this, Arsinoe's like, boy, you're gonna die. And we believe she has her mentor and eunuch Ganymedes off Achilles. Achilles dies.
Bye, Achilles.
Achilles is gone. So
also, can we just praise her eunuch for like 2 seconds?
Yeah,
because he really just killed this, like, he killed Achilles.
He killed Achilles. This man we just hyped up for a solid 45 seconds, he's dead now.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
he's gone. And the eunuch didn't get any praise. Go eunuch,
for real. Ganymedes getting them gains.
Yeah.
I'm
not even calling him by his name. I really just said, like,
the eunuch. Okay. Yeah.
the eunuch.
However, for all purposes, we do have to give Arsinoe some credit here. She just went up to, like, this military general, and then he was like, I doubt you, little girl. And then she was like, boy, bye. I don't have time for this. I have to lead an army.
Let me kill you.
She said, I have to lead an army, take back a country, like, what have you. So, next, now that we have Arsinoe's army, the Arsinoe's army is going to return to Alexandria, and Caesar was ready for this counterattack, but he was not ready for, like, the force that they would bring. So they hold their own. And when I say they, I mean Arsinoe's army, because she's leading an army. She's proclaimed herself. Wow. She's at this time proclaimed herself queen, but she is in fact the general of this army with Ganymedes, her second in command. So her army goes back to Alexandria, shows Caesar, like, the works, and it's like so successful they're able to corner Julius Caesar himself into the Lighthouse of Alexandria, which the Lighthouse of Alexandria is one of the 7 natural wonders of the world. Or not natural, wow. But like 7 wonders of the world. So
yeah.
I'd like to go someday. He's at the top of the, so Caesar's at the top of this lighthouse. And let's take a moment to pause and reflect on this.
Okay.
This is a man who has encircled the Mediterranean. Then he yes. comes to this tiny little corner in Egypt. This man thought he couldn't be cornered. And here he is, up a lighthouse, being cornered by a 14-year-old girl.
Can you imagine? Like, she's so powerful. She said, in the corner. She put him in the corner.
For real.
She really did.
Yeah. And Caesar's like, oh my god, this is the worst. I see why your sister hates you. Wow. When in reality, I think the rivalry that occurred between Arsinoe and Cleopatra was just like a power struggle, because Arsinoe is naturally a badass, and then Cleopatra is kind of like has her way and gets what she wants. I think that was the tension there, in my opinion.
Like, I wonder what freaking, I don't know, like when they had to coexist, what was that like for them?
I don't know.
I mean, they had to coexist like all the time, but like, you know what I mean.
When
like, there's no choice.
When they coexisted, I think it was still when Ptolemy and Cleopatra were co-rulers and sister wife brother husband deal.
Mm-hmm.
It was this whole thing, and Arsinoe was on Cyprus at the kids' table with with Ptolemy the 14th, little boy. I love him. He's literally my, like, I want to adopt him. I've never met him. He existed multiple millennia ago. I want to adopt him. And so, back to the story. Julius Caesar's in his corner in his little lighthouse, and he's overlooking the sea. And he's like, okay, I could jump and potentially kill myself, or I could just be captured. What do you think he does?
So what does he do? He jumps. Because why wouldn't Julius Caesar?
But this is important. Before he does that, he sheds his purple cloak and armor. Now, that purple cloak represents royalty, and it represents who Julius Caesar's, like, who and what Julius Caesar stands for. He sees himself as this big hoity-toity figure that will go down in history, and he will go down in history. But he sheds that because this little girl cornered him in a lighthouse.
Yeah. So she really, like, stripped him of, like, everything. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I feel like that cloak was kind of like him.
Yeah.
Like, it was supposed to be like what he was characterized by. Yeah. And then he just took it off.
Yeah. He was supposed
to. Also, why? Like, why did he take it off?
Because he was about to go for a swim.
Why couldn't he do it with an on?
I don't know if it would like drag him down or like what.
But... oh, yeah. It was probably heavy. Yeah.
So he sheds it, and then Arsinoe picks it up, waves it like a victory flag, and which, Queen. Good for her. Good for her.
Yeah.
And then the story's not over. So our little boy, Caesar, is rescued.
Not our little boy, but...
yeah, not our little boy. Our little boy is Ptolemy the 14th. Yeah. so many Ptolemies. And Julius Caesar gets on this Roman rescue boat. And who does he run into? None other than Cleopatra's brother husband, Ptolemy the 8th. And Ptolemy the 8th is now like a bargaining piece for the Egyptian people. They want peace more than anything. And so the arrangement works out. Ptolemy is exchanged for Arsinoe.
Wow.
Because the reason I think that happens is because Ptolemy was like the leader. And when Caesar rolled up the first time, he was kind of on board with having Ptolemy and Cleopatra be co-rulers. Maybe they could work out their differences. But now that Ptolemy would be back on the throne, like, it'd be this whole deal. And also, I think Julius Caesar just personally hated Arsinoe and was like, I want this girl dead. Because what would happen to Arsinoe when she gets back to Rome, she would be paraded through the streets and then murdered. As, like, a ceremony type of deal. And I think Julius Caesar wanted that. And you know who else probably really wanted that?
Who?
That jealous bitch, Cleopatra.
Damn.
So.
Cleo, chill out.
Cleo, calm down, girl. Relax, relax. It's like that Claire. Video. I think it's like that video of Cardi B throwing her shoe. Where she's like, what was the reason? Yeah.
Dude, Cardi B has like memes for everything. Like whenever there's a new something going on, she always has like a new video out.
Yeah. As crazy. As I retell this story, I see Cleopatra as Cardi B.
I see that. Oh my gosh.
So now that's going like... forward, if you're not imagining Cardi B as I'm telling you the story of Arsinoe and Cleopatra, just you're what are you doing? What are you doing? Whatever. It's beside the point. So this the exchange between Ptolemy and Arsinoe goes through. Arsinoe is handed over to Julius Caesar. Ptolemy is back on the throne. So we think Egypt should be fine now, right? Wrong. What happens? Ptolemy keeps fighting. Caesar keeps fighting. Roman reinforcements roll up and they beat the shit out of Egypt. Okay. So oops. With that, Cleopatra is now the figurehead of Egypt. She got what she wanted. And Julius Caesar's like, okay, baby, I'll be back. Does he come back? Great question. Great question.
Wait, does he? I actually don't.
No, I think he gets murdered on the Senate floor in like 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
Because he gets stabbed how many times?
23.
23 times. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for playing along at home if you knew that answer.
I was so excited about that. Yeah, you were. Wow.
So anyways, Cleopatra gains after Rome kind of wreaks havoc. And now Arsinoe is on her way back to Rome, where she is going to be paraded. Because that's how Romans celebrate things. They're going to celebrate Caesar's 4 triumphs in 46 BC. It's also worth noting that at this time, we predict Cleopatra could have been as young as 17 years old.
So, like, my age.
Yeah. So we expect she's about 17 at this time, as she's about to be paraded through the streets to her execution. So, Caesar's 4 triumphs were celebrated in a parade through the streets. The public was there. They loved this these shenanigans. There was chanting. There was songs. There was hijinks. There was, like, a public and a citizenry that was really into it. They lived for this shit. And Caesar's 4 triumphs would be 4 parades on 4 different days held in this order. Gaul would be the first day. Egypt would be the second day. That's the one with Arsinoe. Then it would be Asia Minor. Then North Africa. And during these parades, they would show off all the jewels, all the people that they conquered, like all this thing. Basically, right. It's what I imagine like homecoming week is, but for like ancient civilization. Yeah. And if you were one of those unfortunate people, at the end of the parade, you probably got executed in a ceremonious way. So Gaul happens the first day, and this is a fun little story. So Gaul's first day, Egypt's second day. On that first day with Gaul, something interesting happens to Caesar. In this parade, he's rolling through, he's waving to the crowd, he's kissing babies, he's doing that thing that politicians love to do. And his chariot is passing the Temple of Fortuna. Fortuna is symbolic for Romans for luck, goddess of luck. And as his chariot is passing the Temple of Luck, one of the wheels on his chariot snaps off and Caesar goes flying. The public is like, "Whoa!"
He really fell, didn't he?
Silence.
He really...
They quickly replace the wheel, but the public, who's very superstitious, very religious, they believe what they believe. And they just saw this happen with their own two eyes, so they're not having it. They're just like, "Oh my god, this is happening, our ruler is doomed." This is probably foreshadowing his death 2 years later, where he stabbed on the Senate floor 23 times. Cue Gretchen Wieners saying, "Why don't we all just stab Caesar?" Yeah. If you don't know that quote, watch Mean Girls. If you haven't watched Mean Girls, go do it right now.
What are you
go
doing?
Go do it right now.
It's like part of our like American.
It's
history
part of the
quilt.
Culture. Yeah.
It is.
And anyways, speaking of Mean Girls, this little Arsinoe character, during her parade, she's walking through the crowd and the public is taking a liking to her. We don't know if she said anything or did anything, but at the same time, whatever she said or did, it worked. they kind of then get uneasy with the idea of having a 17-year-old girl that they like murdered before their very eyes. And they're like, hey, Caesar, don't kill her. And then Caesar's like, okay, fine, whatever. I'd rather have an upset public than an upset girlfriend across the Mediterranean. This Cleopatra was still jealous of her sister, even though she was across the Mediterranean. She's kind of that type. She's petty. She's a petty bitch. So,
she gives me that
she
vibe.
She does give that vibe. So, Arsinoe, instead of being put to death, is assigned to the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. So, she would live out her days kind of worshipping the goddess Artemis, living a very solemn, calm life. And with her sisterhood, there were some eunuchs there that she was quite fond of. And in 41 BC, after Julius Caesar has died and Mark Antony has risen to power. Mm-hmm. What do we think happens when Rome gets a new figurehead and Cleopatra still wants to maintain her influence?
Hold on, I'm yawning.
she has her. She shows Mark Antony the Egyptian way. And yeah, they were lovers. So then her new boyfriend, she goes to him. She goes, "Hey, there's this girl in this Temple of Artemis. Can you, maybe, can you go get her for me?" And Mark Antony's like, "Sure, okay, whatever." And Mark Antony orders the murder of Arsinoe, and she's murdered in 41 BC in an act that scandalized Rome. Okay. So,
good.
Yeah, people were like, "That's not good. We can't just kill people." Especially people at the Temple of Artemis, because that was like sacrilege. And
right.
If you're wondering what happens to Cleopatra, a decade later, she kills herself in 30 BC by poisoning. It's not a snake, people. She does not kill herself by a snake. She is poisoned by she poisons herself. And she does this in response to Octavian's forces invading Egypt, because she'd rather die than be captured. So, yeah.
Just like Julius.
So, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, they were made for each other. So,
you were.
So, what did we learn from this? We learned that Arsinoe, is one of those figures in history that more people need to know about if they don't already. Because, let's talk about this, we think Julius Caesar is kind of this, like, amazing figure who we, like, kind of worship. He did all of these things, like, he was hugely successful. But here he is being cornered in a lighthouse by a little girl. That same little girl who stood up to an Egyptian rebel army general and was like, "Oh, you doubt me? Boy, you're done. You're gonna die." And she lived her life. And we have to talk about that. This little girl changed the world. There's a quote from Matilda the Musical that says, "Even if you're little, you can do a lot." And I think that applies to Arsinoe perfectly. Because she was... I think about it. She started off at the kids' table at Cyprus. Then she was almost becoming the ruler of Egypt when she corners like one of the most like the most powerful figure in the world at that time into a lighthouse. And history doesn't know about her. We needed to take her more seriously. It doesn't matter that she's a kid. Achilles literally died believing that. So
yeah.
Never underestimate the power of a determined little girl. Okay. And on that note, we're now going to transition into Catherine's cute little story time for today, which we talk about. Oh my gosh, it's been so long since I've. It's green corporatism. Yes?
Yes.
Ooh, I did it, guys. Okay. Yes. Well, get excited. You need to pause, go take a break, take a breather, digest Arsinoe's story and legacy. Go ahead and do that. But meet us back here for Catherine's history time.
Okay, are we ready?
Oh, I've never been more ready for anything in my entire life.
Okay, good. This is like an expose. So, just to preface this, it won't make sense completely in, like, the David and Goliath theme won't until, like, the very end. So,
be patient. I'm excited.
Okay, so today, we're going to be talking about the beginning of something. But to preface it, we have to talk about something else, which is climate change, the thing slowly killing us and our environment. We've all seen the headlines. I mean, even now in the time of COVID-19, we can see how, like, much the climate change community has really proliferated our media. Because, I mean, we have advocates saying that less human activity has actually resulted in lower pollution levels in places like China and, like, clear water in places like Venice, Italy, who got hit, like, super hard by COVID. And we can see how, like, even in a time of, like, straight COVID news, we see environment and the climate debate just, like, still so prevalent, right? That's, like, a huge thing nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that that's not how it always was. In fact, prior to what I would say, like, the 1960s, climate change activists were really seen as, like, the hippie kind of, like, pot-smoking libertarian uncle you invite to the cookout because you feel bad. That's kind of the equivalent that I've seen as. Like, they were really seen as just, mm-hmm. like, the outside. Like, they weren't really a thing. And it wasn't...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What do you think the turning point was? Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring.
Shut up! Yes!
Is that what you're going to talk about?
Okay. I literally... Wow. Wow.
I didn't mean to, like, steal your thunder, but I was like, holy...
I have a little part about that. Wow.
I see, like, where this is going. Wow.
Wow. What a concept. We'll get to Rachel. Don't worry about it.
We love Rachel.
Yes. Okay. So, I don't think that congressionally, at least, not, like, in the, I don't know how to put that, like, I think the most recent that I can, like, go back to where, like, it might be, like, cognizant for, like, whoever listens to this is probably, like, the 90s with politicians like Al Gore and, you know, like, the 70s with people like Lyndon B. Johnson, that kind of, like, changed legislatively. But there's more, like, there's more history stuff to that. We'll get to it. So, just to preface again, this is quite critical stuff. It's stuff that not a lot of people really know about today. And it's stuff that a lot more people should know about because it affects us every single day. Every decision you make as a consumer, every decision you make as a person living on Earth. So today we're going to be talking about the dark history of what I call green corporatism. Now, I hope we can find, like, a sound effect that's like dun dun dun, because trust me, it's warranted. So I'll define green corporatism. What I would define green corporatism as is when corporations take special interest in the environmental conversation. How that plays out is interesting, and it takes on a lot of various forms. In fact, I was super surprised to find out that the earliest form of this type of corporatism began as early as World War II. Now, yeah, the rationale was, like, very different, though. Like, we didn't have Uncle Sam posters pointing and saying, go green. But things like recycling began as a consequence of World War II.
Oh.
Yeah, I literally had no idea. But, like, people were urged to recycle cans, nylons, and tins order to make stuff like toothpaste tubes for soldiers and, like, stuff like that, which, like, I never thought of. Like, that's why recycling started. Like, even before, you know, like, climate and, like, environment and conservation efforts were really, like, big. Like, there was recycling because war, which is interesting. So, following the history of that, by the 1960s, the conservation efforts we saw from, like, the Taft administrations and the Wilson administrations had developed into this new kind of environmentalism. Now, we can credit this, as I wrote in my notes, to Rachel Carson and her handy-dandy little book. It was kind of... Do you want to talk about it, Blake?
Off the cuff, I can just say I know it, like, galvanized the movement, as literature often does. Like, if we talk about, like, books that changed the world, it's definitely got to be on there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's a shift.
Yep. And so Rachel Carson, her book, and people like President Lyndon B. Johnson, who was historically known as a huge environmentalist, that actually pushed environmental legislation in the 70s, and that was the real big, like, turning point. Now let's go on to the 70s, where this kind of turns into a more consumer thing. It was kind of more of a convenience, you know, like, context. The 70s is really when I imagine, like, this huge consumerism point where people were, like, spending money and, like, you know what I'm talking about.
That the society we live in today. Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know people were talking about, like, that show Dynasty and how, like, literally the show Dynasty, like, invented consumerism.
Yeah. Literally. Like, we have this, like, shifting culture of, like, it's not only, like, surviving. It's material, like, we want to live, baby. We want to live lavish. Like,
I want my MTV.
Right. Like, people wanted, like, Art Deco and shit. Like, that was kind of the 60s going into 70s.
Andy frickin' Warhol.
Yes.
Is he the one who painted the... Sorry, I'm going to sound like an imbecile. Is he the one who painted the can of soup?
Yeah, the Campbell soup can. He is.
People were just like, this is America.
Yeah, this is us, guys.
Yeah.
This is us. So, So now it's the 70s, and public policy and urban planning people began to realize, you know that, like, landfill, like, corner in town that we just kind of ignore? Yeah, what if, like, maybe that's not, like, the most amazing idea for us? You know, like, what if that's not, like, the thing we should be doing? And this kind of translated into a new movement of curbside recycling. And that's kind of where the story gets really interesting. Now we have people that are looking around and saying, what is our world becoming? Like, what is our footprint really doing right here? Like, okay, I see the landfill, but, like, are there more landfills? And, like, are they worse? What are, like, the companies doing right now? Like, what's going on? Are our oceans, like, good? Are they doing well right now?
Do we even
now?
Know things about our oceans?
I don't know. I feel like we're talking about this, like, the 70s, like, the most archaic thing ever. And, like, somebody that was, like, born in the 70s is like, shut the fuck up right now. And we're like, sorry.
We're just like, way back when.
Right.
50 years ago in 1970. Right.
Exactly. So now we're getting to the good part. Companies start realizing that, oh shit, we've kind of been doing some really shady stuff. And by really shady stuff, I mean, like, we've killed a couple trees, and by a couple trees, I mean, like, a whole forest.
The Amazon.
Right. we might have contributed making the air kind of brownish, but, like, you know, just on a Tuesday. So now they're like, okay, well, what the hell do we do about this? And then some really savvy PR person, I imagine, like, walked into a meeting with, like, a briefcase and said, well, if we can't kill them, let's fucking join them. You know, let's fucking do it. Like, what could go wrong? So then...
Hold up. How do we imagine that person? Are they wearing, like, hipster glasses?
No, for some reason, I envision, you know, those, like, cartoons that are, like, really pointed and have, like, a really pointy nose for, like, no reason. And their, like, eyes are, like, just a line. Yeah. You know those cartoons? I imagine that person with a briefcase and a brown suit. Like, that's what I imagine. And it's like an infographic. And they're walking in and they're like, I am ready.
The CEO is smoking a cigar.
Oh, yeah.
It is,
for
it
sure.
It is the cigar that started the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fires in the Rag Den.
Yeah, they're just ready to, you know, fuck people over.
It's called drawing historical connections, people.
Continuities in history
over time.
Yes. Okay. So this is where we see that kind of shift of organizations being, like, very specific about their advertising. So one of the big examples of this, and apparently when I was doing research on this, a lot of people in the 70s can actually really, like, recall this specific commercial that was called The Crying Indian. Other than being politically incorrect, there's a lot of other stuff wrong with this. So this commercial showed a Native American man canoeing down a river full of trash, looking around solemnly and seeing how, like, bad his surroundings were, right? And the commercial ends with a narration of someone saying, quote, people start pollution, comma, people stop it, unquote. So,
oh,
yeah, it's a very like, this is your fucking fault kind of thing. And here we begin to see the culmination of a couple things. We start to see a shift to individual accountability from corporations, which is going to be like the biggest thing ever. So how this manifests into a lot of people and a lot of corporations is they're like, okay, so now we know what we're going to do. We have a game plan. Let's materialize it. And this materialized into organizations and nonprofits like that of Keep America Beautiful, which is the biggest example we have today of green corporatism. Okay, so this organization was founded in the 1950s by none other than our favorite Coca-Cola.
But I love Coca-Cola.
I know. What am I gonna do without a Diet Coke? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? What's going on?
I have a Diet Coke bottle literally right here. I'm gonna hold the camera so Catherine can see.
Wow, it's empty.
It is empty.
It's empty. Okay, so it was founded in the 1950s, and the stated goal of this organization was supposedly to, get this, educate and activate the public. Okay, sister. Okay, word. So they kind of targeted people by saying, like, pick up litter, and they really pushed the narrative of, like, do your part, Karen. You know, like, do it. It's your fault. Clean up your litter. You know, it was kind of this whole thing. However, Keep America Beautiful, while they were paying for, like, pretty sceneries and, like, Calibri-fonted commercials, they were also actively thwarting climate change legislation and lobbying against the legislation that was supposed to help the climate. Like, what? Are you kidding? Are you joking? Are you okay? What's happening?
That's fake. That's Regina George
level. Yeah. Yes. I said so fiery now because I'm just like annoyed because I'm like, are you fucking kidding? Okay.
Imagine if they like spent their resources doing things that would genuinely benefit as opposed to just like,
oh, could never. Why would we do that when we can just like pay things to go away?
Wow.
Yeah.
Smoking beers.
In fact, from 1989 to 1994, they spent a total of, get this, $14 million. $14 million to defeat the National Bottle Bill. Now, this bill would have kind of revolutionized a lot of things. Okay, even now, I would consider this on a national level, like, crazy. Like, by today's standards of, like, hyper-environmentalism. This bill would have put a tax on plastic materials on business and a consumer level. So that means businesses would have had a larger tax and consumers would have had a larger tax. And you know how people get over more taxes. We're America. We are founded on the hatred of taxes, okay?
That is the crux of our nation.
Right. That is like, you want to get people angry? Tell them their taxes are going to go up. Even if they go up every single time we start a war. But that's another episode. Anyways, I think that this is an example that perfectly encapsulates the nature of green corporatism. Because we have this company saying one thing, but doing literally the opposite. And we see this all over. And we see the consequences that it causes. And the consequence is really like our world. And I picked this example mostly because I've mentioned it in both one of my nationals cases and in essay that I wrote that I was supposed to not know a lot about, but oh well. Anyhow, but there's a lot of other examples that we see. For example, like if you guys want to do independent research and are like invigorated by this topic, which you should be, by the way,
get organizations pissed.
Yeah, Catherine's like that,
she's giving you a green card to get pissed.
Yeah, literally a green card. Anyhow, organizations prompted by General Motors, Delta, other Coca-Cola sponsored stuff are just some examples of like organizations that have done stuff very similar to this. And wow. I think the today example of stuff like this is just seen like over like a summer ago, the plastic straw movement completely just took social media and like it just said mine. And if you remember, you couldn't like go anywhere.
The Save the Turtles people.
Oh, for sure. Like Visco. Girls. Even Visco had like Save the Turtles. And I was like, I swear to all things holy. So let's not forget that Starbucks notably took hold of that and said, well, we're not going to do those anymore. We're going to do, like, plastic lids. Like, thanks. Thanks for that. Thank you. What a hero.
Like, I ordered Starbucks, like, prior to COVID-19. And
I order Starbucks still. On the daily. It's my only drive-thru.
It is what it is. But the drink I usually get, I can't remember if it was a caramel macchiato or a latte. Some gay shit. And it came with the new type of lid. And I was just absolutely astounded. I was like, yes, Starbucks.
The nitro cold brew lids, yes.
The
yes,
nitro I know cold what you mean. Brew. Yeah. No, that's what it was. It was with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
I was with you. Okay.
That was the day we got yelled at. Oops.
Oh, that's another
We don't yell. Talk about it.
We don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Silence. Okay.
Yep. Okay. So my biggest worry is that because of this new shifting accountability that has become ever so prevalent in our media, governments are accepting it rather than challenging it and fighting for our environment. We can look at countries like Brazil, where this type of green corporatism has seeped into their government. I mean, their government is actively trying to blame the deforestation onto people. In fact, a spokesperson blamed deforestation as a whole on the public's apathy and basically implied that the destruction of the forest was a prerequisite for economic development.
Oh.
And then he tied in the people and said, that's what the people want. And, like, there's so much wrong with that. Like, so much.
But, sir, what does the Amazon want?
Yeah, first of all, sir. And I encourage anybody that wants to know more about this to go to commondreams.org that made a very, 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 very good argument against this spokesperson and said, quote, development versus conservation aren't mutually exclusive. Okay, you can have both. In fact, according to them, Rondais, which is a neighboring state, has made billions from preserving the forest and becoming sustainable. So economic development and being a rich country, whatever, is not exclusive to, like, killing the planet. Like, those two things don't coexist. They aren't, like tied, okay? Like, well, I don't know when that notion, like, became a thing.
And if you think about it, if you take a look at, like, the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, where he established conservation efforts and had economic growth within the country, like,
right, like
that was a century ago, but at the same time, like, that was only a century ago,
right? Like, I don't, like, and we see the same thing with, like, the Paris Accord, where, like,
oh my god,
POTUS said, well, we can't, like, succeed economically. I'm like, I that's literally not it, but okay, I swear.
The Paris Accord, just like,
oh my god, literally mind is breaking. So I think the big tie-in to Blake's story here is very reminiscent of, again, David and Goliath, which
let's just break this down here. Let's think about what message we could be trying to send. I am Blake. I told a story about a little girl who took on one of the most powerful beings in world history. So this little girl challenged the establishment and was able to do remarkable things and was spared multiple times by her public support and her ability to reason with people and gain traction in the hearts and minds of citizens. Then we have Catherine, who talks about the environmental movement. If you haven't picked up on, like,
the clues
on, like, who or what we're trying to talk about today, either you have been living under a rock, or
your brain is the rock.
or you are the 45th president of the United States of America.
Oh, dear Lord. Okay, dear Lord. So what we're trying to say here is that you are the David. We are the David here. We've been consistently sold this narrative by what I label as, and I said this in my essay, the corporate coalition of lies. And we've been consistently made to believe that this is somehow our fault. And we somehow, like, the individual has to, like, figure out how the fuck to fix it. Yeah. And let us not forget, like, the statistics and the facts are telling us exactly the opposite. Just 25 companies make up 71% of the industrial emissions in the world. 25. 15 U.S. food and beverage companies generate 630 million metric tons of greenhouse gases every year. Can you conceptualize that number, Blake? Can you?
I cannot. I'm not a maths person.
Yeah. I think even a math person, like, could not even, like, I can't begin to fathom 1 million metric tons. I don't even want to picture 630 million
metric tons. If Greta Thunberg were here, she could do it. Oh, it's Greta Thunberg, by the way. I don't know if we should have said that, but, like,
oh yeah.
Greta Thunberg, guys.
Greta Thunberg. So that amount of greenhouse gas is more than the whole country of, like, Australia. May I just say, like, that's just 15 US food and beverage companies.
Wow.
Yeah.
America is the worst.
Yeah. So now let's talk about Green New Deal. How's that sound?
Oh, that sounds like it's going to get controversial. I don't know what the Green New Deal is.
Okay, word. So the Green New Deal is basically this proposition from Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez that basically kind of sets new guidelines and new parameters for what the U.S. should be following in terms of, like, carbon emissions and a bunch of other stuff. Now, this is where the conservative part of me comes in. I love the intent. I think it's amazing. I think it's important. And I think the conservation harms versus benefits will always outweigh. However, I do acknowledge that there is concern when it comes to, like, federal power. I do also acknowledge that when it comes to a debate, Fed power over our literal Earth, I would contend that our Earth kind of, you know, like, should come as the priority. That's me.
That's your, yeah. And if you think about, like, we pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, so we really have no checked regulation.
Right. I think a lot of it is very valuable.
Yeah.
I think we always end like this with, like, a huge sigh.
Yeah.
We're just like, what is happening?
What's occurring? Hopefully this podcast reaches someone. Hopefully someone leaves this podcast feeling empowered. Like, oh.
Right.
Look at all these things Arsinoe did. I'm going to go kill Achilles. I'm going to go slay Goliath.
So I think the crux of it is, like, even if you can't change it, because, like, by any measure, you could live the actual worst life environmentally. That literally will do net zero to, like, any of the environmental problems going on. But you know what you can do? You can vote for people that will enact legislation that can do something. You can use your voice on social media and tell people that don't know about, like, this whole, like, Keep America Beautiful and, like, the commercials and the organizations trying to, like, literally lie to you that that's happening. You can do so much. So much.
You can, yeah. And,
like,
the thing is, you can do so much, but the one thing you can't do is not care.
Exactly. Like, even if you're, like, 60 right now and you're like, okay, this won't affect me. Okay. And sure, it won't affect you. It will affect your children.
And it's not like you need to go out, start a nonprofit, do all of these things. It's like, maybe, I don't know, recycle.
I mean, yeah, as much as, like, we don't want to, like, feed into the narrative of, like, oh, it's your fault. Like,
or if you see if you see a piece of trash on the ground, maybe, like, recycle it or throw it away. Maybe just don't be a garbage human.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But also vote for people that care, mm-hmm. please. Oh my god, please. Please vote for people that care. That's kind of where I think we'll find our middle ground here. Just fucking...
So...
Just please
vote. In a world full of Coca-Colas, be an Arsinoe. That's the metaphor of today.
That's perfect. That is, I that love is it.
The summation of this.
If we ever like get a sponsorship from Coca-Cola, they'll literally look back on this podcast and be like, you know what?
Money?
NVM.
Gone. And we're going to be like, please, sir, we need this money.
Yeah. Go college, please.
For real. College is scary and expensive.
Oh my gosh.
So, on that note, we are, I think, going to call it a night.
We are indeed
going to call it a night after our deep talks about, what was it, corporate greenism?
Green corporatism? One of them.
Yes.
I don't know.
So, next week, tune in. I can't tell you what we're going to be talking about.
I thought you were going to bring up what you were going to be talking about, and I was going to be like, I am once again telling you that I do
we're
not
know.
We're
both going in blind, so...
Yes.
Tune in next week to see what we're talking about. I know Catherine and I are excited to figure out what that is ourselves.
Oh, yes. For sure.
So with that, we hope you enjoyed today's story time. We hope you learned. We hope you grew as a person.
It was shorter than usual.
It's all good. Stay safe in the scary world and have a great day or night. All right. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye.
See ya.